Monster Professor.
Welcome to the Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert, and today I have the immense honor and privilege of talking with somebody who is a real monster expert. I sometimes call myself the monster expert and the monster professor, and today I'm speaking with somebody who has actually proved that he is so, because you've actually heard me reference his books on this show many times before. If you've listened to any previous episodes, whether you've realized it or not, Monsters, An Investigator's Guide to Magical Beings, and the book The New Encyclopedia of the Occult. But these are just a couple of his many books. And I'm speaking, of course, of John Michael Greer. Now, John Michael Greer is a widely read author and blogger. His work focuses on the overlaps between ecology and spirituality and the future of industrial society. How many books has he published on just spirituality and the occult? At least 24 books, including those two that were hugely influential on me. You'll hear more about it when I get to talk with him in a moment. And of his books of fiction, at least 10 books, 5 anthologies at least, I've counted, and 10 published books on peak oil and the future of ecology and industry. And this doesn't even take into account his wide range of essays and articles. He served 12 years as Grand Archdruid of the Ancient Order of Druids in America, and currently heads the Druidical Order of the Golden Dawn. He currently lives in East Providence, Rhode Island. For those Lovecraft fans out there, then a question is burning in your head about that, and we get to that in this conversation. And he lives there with his wife, Sarah. And not only is he a brilliant polymath, but he's also quite generous and patient, because in just trying to contact him, I had all sorts of technical difficulties and the call was not going through, and that had never happened to me before, and I was sweating bullets and I'm freaking out because I had John Michael Greer on my list of my dream list of guests, and that he said yes was a huge excitement to me. And then there it was at the exact moment we're supposed to do the interview, and I'm screwing something up. I'm freaking out. He was patient enough to wait on me while I did some troubleshooting and found an alternative solution to get to contact him. And then he let me know rather generously that Mercury is in retrograde. And he also, of course, had to explain to me what that even means. But he says that that affects communications and makes communication difficult in many different ways. And I'm happy to put the blame on Mercury, but the truth was, it was actually just my inexperience. I was screwing something up. And he was quite generous, not only to be patient with me through that, but to give me a lot more time than I had promised I would take from him. And so I hope you're going to enjoy this conversation as much as I clearly did. Without further ado, here is my conversation with John Michael Greer. So I wanted to first share with you and the listeners as well a little bit about why I'm so excited to get to speak with you. In part because years back when I ran across this book in the bookstore called The New Encyclopedia of the Occult, and I didn't even have the cash for it. And so, like, I scrounged up money and came back a week later and got this thing. And it obsessed my life, for it ended up being one of the most immersive reading experiences I've ever had. It's up there with Lovecraft, Tolkien, and Borges. And I would put this thing.
Good heavens. Okay. I mean, that's extremely, no, that's extremely exalted company to be around, to be hanging out with. Still, I'm delighted. It's, that book was enormous fun to write, and just gathering all the information and putting everything together. And you know, it's been very widely read. Of course, it's still very much in print.
Yeah, and it created, like, in this disjointed way, because I didn't read from start to finish, mm-hmm. from front to back, since it's an encyclopedia, I was jumping around, but mm-hmm. every one thing connected to another, and it created this whole mm-hmm. picture in my mind. It ended up obsessing me so much that I based my graduate thesis in college on it, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I did. Mm-hmm. It was a fiction thesis, because I have an MFA in creative writing fiction, and so I did. Mm-hmm. I tried my hand at a novel written as an encyclopedia, John Michael Greer style, with plenty of the occult in it as well.
And interesting. That could be fun.
It could be fun. I don't think it worked like I thought it would as fiction. I think it works better the way you did it. But then,
I could see Borges doing something like that.
Yeah, no, he would.
I could definitely see Borges doing something like that. And if he ever had, I'd want to read it.
Yeah, he would. And I guess my love of Borges actually kind of went like that too, kind of encyclopedic. Mm-hmm. But and then years later, I got a gift from a friend of mine who is also a SWAT team trainer and a sheriff's deputy.
Wow.
And mm-hmm. he's a bit like Hopper on Stranger Things, if you or any of my mm-hmm. listeners know who the character is. And he sent me this book, Monsters, by John Michael Greer, an investigator, an investigator's guide to magical beings. And once again, my mind is blown. I am obsessed with this thing. And on top of that, I've, you know, looking around, and we've got a wider range of interests as well, like, I'm reading this fantastic article on the ancient art of memory, and in this article, it's also teaching me the Latin declensions. Don't test me on it right now, but anyway, I was there.
I won't, but I remember the article well.
And then I come to find out, I'm like, that guy has the same name as the John Michael Greer that I'm a fan of, and it was, of course, the same guy. And then I have a colleague who publishes with Paul Kingsnorth's Dark Mountain Project, and I'm like, there he is again, John Michael Greer. He is all over the place. When I first started putting this show together, on my wish list was a whole episode dedicated to John Michael Greer, and I just wanted to find an expert to talk to about John Michael Greer, and not until recently did it hit me. What if I just ask him? I wonder what would happen. And so,
you would probably get me on your show. Yeah.
So that's at least a short version of why it's such a huge honor and a pleasure to
talk
with
you. There we go. I have to say though, the thought that there would be an expert on John Michael Greer out there, you know, a professor of Greerology or something like that, it's kind of dizzying. Usually that happens after I die, and so I hope to postpone it as long as possible.
Yeah, let's postpone that. Well, I didn't even throw in, like, my interest in European sword fighting, and then there you are again. So I've called people a Renaissance man on this show, and it's always been a metaphor, but with you, in many ways, you're a Renaissance man. So I'm going to shut up for a minute. I want to find out, where in the world did you come from? Where did this wide range of interest come from?
Well, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Well, not quite actually. When I was young, growing up in the suburbs around Seattle, Washington, you know, suburbia, some people really like suburbia. I hated it from the time I was like 3 years old, and it was boring. It was dull, and everybody and everything that I saw around me, my parents, my teachers, everybody was basically seemed to be involved in this great conspiracy to make the world look incredibly dull. And so I became obsessed with anything that wasn't the sort of plastic two-dimensional thing that you get in a suburban lifestyle. So monsters were, of course, an early and frequent interest. I was crazy about monsters when I was small. And I proceeded from there to the whole range of unexplained phenomena. This was, by that time, the 70s were getting on, and the big boom in books on unexplained phenomena was really hitting its stride. Found out about cryptozoology in my junior high school years. They had a copy in the library of Bernard Heuvelmann's On the Track of Unknown Animals. That was all she wrote where that was concerned. So I got got into cryptozoology at that time, but I was also developing the whole time an interest in occultism. I grew up with a lot of fantasy fiction. I read Tolkien's Lord of the Rings for the first time at the age of 10. Three-quarters of it went over my head, but who cares? It was wonderful. I literally opened the cover, climbed and closed it back. I was the kind of geeky kid who signed people's junior high school yearbooks in Elvish. And it's just one of those things. And so, but I perceive, the further I got, the further I explored various different things, I started to get a sense that specifically with regard to occultism, there was this whole world of lost knowledge out there that most people were not even aware of, and the sort of pop occultism that you found was just very, very superficial stuff. There was a lot of depth in there. So, you know, time passed. I read and read and read. One of my secret weapons here is that I don't like television. I don't enjoy watching TV. So I literally haven't owned one in my adult life. And that means I have 4 to 6 more hours a day than most people do. So I did a lot of study, practiced a lot of strange things, got initiated into various occult orders and traditions and things like that. All the usual stuff. If you're kind of a magic geek the way I am, learned enough Latin and enough French to start doing some translations. Of course, one of those things led to my translation of The Academy of the Sword, one of the big book on rapier fencing that you probably have encountered. But it was just a matter of chasing down every angle I could and say, okay, then what's down this way? Wow, there's this thing called the art of memory. I wonder if I can use, you know, I'm going back to college to finish my degree. I wonder if I can use that. I could. Here's this other way, you know, the whole Renaissance swordsmanship business, the Renaissance sacred geometry, various kinds of traditions of initiation, monster lore. I was not expecting to find that. I mean, I'd been, as I mentioned, I was crazy about monsters when I was small. I mean, by the age of 10, I was kind of an expert in werewolf lore. But I kind of set that aside about the time I turned 15 or 16 because I was getting interested in other things. Then I was getting into the cryptozoology and some of these other stuff. But then I get to some of the works by Eliphas Levi, who was the guy who really relaunched magic into the modern world back in the 1850s. And he has a chapter in one of his most famous books on werewolves. And I was going, huh? But indeed, he did, and he talks about what's actually going on here. Various other people talk about what's going on with vampirism, some of the deeper levels of this stuff. And that was what ended up launching my book, Monsters. It was kind of an odd thing. I'd done some very serious books for Llewellyn Publications, books on ceremonial magic, books on Kabbalistic philosophy, books on magical lodges and herbal magic and all this kind of stuff. And I was kind of at a point of, well, I don't know, what do I want to do now? And I just got the idea of doing a book on monsters from the point of view of traditional occult philosophy. And I have rarely had so much fun writing a book. Partly it was revisiting all the fascinations of my childhood. Partly it's just monsters are fun. Let's face it, monsters are just a lot of fun. And so I ended up writing this thing. I had access to a really good university library at that point, which had things like anthropological folklore studies of vampire folklore from Transylvania. You want to know what vampires are like? Talk to the Transylvanians. And things like that. And I just buried myself in this wild mess of stuff, came up with this book, sent it to the publishers, and said, okay, that was a kind of a lark. Now I'll go on to something else. That book is still my best-selling occult title.
No kidding.
Hands down.
Anyone who's listened to these episodes, every time I get into like, well, what now that we've talked about this monster in, say, literature or film or folklore, what do you do if you have a problem with it? And I normally go to your book, actually.
I'm glad to hear that. I have heard from a significant number of people who have that book, who were having trouble with, say, a poltergeist or some kind of hostile haunting situation or what have you, who pulled the stuff out of there and got good results. So I feel I've actually did some good in that way.
Yeah, and for anybody who's wondering, like, well, does it really get that pragmatic in the advice? Yeah, like my wife and I even made one of the amulets. I think amulet number the first one in there, and sent it to my friend who gets into some dark places in law enforcement, and I think he keeps it on him on duty. I think. Well, I should ask him. I shouldn't tell him. Say that if that's not entirely true, I'll let him speak for, but he says it's important to him and he keeps it on him. And so it's really, so it's a fantastic book. And I think I want to definitely get back to the Western occult tradition kind of being swept under, well, not kind of, extremely being swept under the rug in history.
Have the crap stomped out of it and then have the remnants swept under the rug. Yeah, exactly.
I want to get back to that, but since we're on the Monsters book in particular, I wanted to talk at least about one in particular, and it's one that hit me right away, and it's the Old Hag. And I wonder if any of my listeners have had this experience, because it's the first encounter I've ever had of a, like, blow by blow perfect description of some of these experiences I've had when I'm lying in, and at least one of my friends lying in bed. And you feel that pressure holding you down. You feel completely paralyzed. So it's in this half waking, half asleep experience. You know, I guess that's kind of what the word nightmare is, this thing on your chest, right? But there's a distinct awareness of an entity or a particular female presence coming closer and closer in the room with some type of deep malevolence. And and you say that's the phenomenon of the Old Hag. And then I learned a little bit about the immigrants of Laos from you. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. The first thing I want to say for all of our listeners is this is an incredibly common experience. David Hufford, who is a medical anthropologist who wrote this book titled The Terror That Comes in the Night, worth reading. He found out, he was doing some research, I think it was in Newfoundland, and ran across references to this experience, which there they call the Old Hag. You get this sense of something sitting on, you know, the malevolent presence coming into the room, the pressure on the chest, the inability to move, the sense of malice and evil, and all this kind of stuff. It's an experience that a lot of people have had. And so he was going, wow, this is kind of interesting. I wonder if anybody else has ever experienced this. And then he found out that the Hmong people from Laos, the Hmong were one of the mountain tribes that fought on our side in the Vietnam War, and a lot of them were able to escape Vietnam when our military pulled out, and came to this country as refugees, and they've settled down in this country. So they had a very high rate of this experience, and had a traditional explanation that there was this particular evil spirit that caused it, and there were certain rites that you can do to keep the evil spirit away, but you have to have certain traditional things available to do that, and they didn't. And so they had a really bad case of these things. But he ended up going on the air in a series of radio shows. And all of a sudden, he was getting hundreds of calls and letters. This was before email, but it would have been emails also.
Yeah.
Of people saying, wow, that has happened to me. I had no idea it ever happened to anyone else. And one of the things this really showed is, first of all, that something could be extremely common. Extremely common, something that literally millions of people have experienced, and nobody talks about it.
Yeah.
Nobody talks about it because people say, well, taboos, primitive tribes have taboos. We don't have taboos. Bull hockey. We have huge taboos, and our number one taboo is magic. Anything that touches on the supernatural, people will wet themselves before they'll talk about it, unless somebody else makes the effort and actually goes out there and talks about it first. And so, for example, in shows that I've been on, radio shows or what have you, where there's a call-in feature, every time I talk about ghosts, for example, people call in and very, very sheepishly describe these perfectly normal ghost encounters that they've had. And what they're doing is, am I crazy? And I say, no, you're not crazy. 25% of Americans have had experiences like that. This is common. And it's just, they're always going, oh, thank you. I was worried that I was losing my mind because I had this happen to me. You know, my grandma died, and that night I saw her walk into the bedroom and just bend over me and pat my forehead and then vanish. I figure, okay, I'm stark staring. No, it's a ghost. It's a perfectly ordinary ghost. Most people in the world, most cultures in the world understand these things, but our culture has a taboo about it. We're neurotic about these things. We're terrified of them.
Yeah, I don't know of any culture, any human culture in all of history, except perhaps for our modern one, that doesn't have mm-hmm. ghosts or spirits as a regular mm-hmm. feature of it. And I've even had a young man tell me on about my show. He goes, "Oh, I like your show, but you shouldn't have done that episode on ghosts." And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "Because they're not monsters; they're real."
Wait a minute. Yeah. No, I mean, there's a lot of monsters that are perfectly real. And it's just, yeah. I mean, as I say in my book, the word monstrum, from Latin monstrum, is a thing that's shown forth. It's something that people see. Okay? Doesn't mean that it's unreal. Quite the contrary.
And a lot of those impulses toward what we might call the magic or the occult, even though they're, say, kind of repressed or pushed aside for one reason or another in our society, they're still going to find their way up. And you make a great point about how much spiritualism, for instance, took over in the 19th century, very nearly took over completely.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, one of the things, this is actually a project that I'm going to be starting to work on next year, so here's you're getting an advance warning ahead of almost anybody else. I have a friend here in Rhode Island who, he's a retired professor of history and linguistics, and he and I are working on a project. We're going to do a magical history of America.
Oh, man, that's going to be
because
cool.
Because this country has been full of magic since about 3 minutes after the settlers jumped off the boat in Jamestown. Not even talking about what the Native Americans had, which was phenomenal, of course, but just in terms of our own American culture, the culture that evolved out of those colonies, out of the whole experience of migration and so on. This was North America was where all kinds of people came from all corners of the world because they could practice their magic without getting burned at the stake or what have you. And so we had, I mean, the first governor of colonial Connecticut was an alchemist, John Winthrop Jr. He was up to his eyeballs in alchemy. We had Rosicrucians getting off the boat from Germany here before the year 1700. They set up a base in Pennsylvania, as you'd expect, with the Pennsylvania Dutch community, and so on and so on and so on. And of course, the African people who were brought over here as slaves, they brought their magic with them. And things blended and fused, and you get hoodoo and conjure and rework and things out of that. And there's just this glorious tale of American magic that nobody's told yet. So, well, you know, it's going to be fun.
Yeah, it doesn't stop with just America. So, you know, to bring my listeners in a little bit on this, like, what are they talking about with this, like, hidden occult history? Well, some of mm-hmm. them might already be familiar with, you know, things they've heard mm-hmm. about, like Adolf Hitler's occult training mm-hmm. with Dietrich Eckhart or the Thule Society. Maybe a mm-hmm. little bit about Rasputin and how, like, mm-hmm. pivotal he was in bringing down Tsarist Russia. And that's about mm-hmm. it. And then you might hear things like, well, Neil deGrasse Tyson, for instance, on an educational documentary will say something like, you know, like, Copernicus and Isaac Newton helped bring us out of the dark ages of mysticism into science and rationality. I'm like, Isaac Newton was a freaking alchemist, first and foremost.
He was an alchemist. He was a good alchemist. He spent more time on alchemy than he spent working out the theory of gravitation.
I mean, that was his life, right? I mean, he dedicated his life to that.
Exactly. He was deeply into it. He was, many of these people, Robert Boyle, the guy who really got chemistry going as an independent science, was another alchemist. There were a lot of these people. It was normal. But we have this amnesia. We have this taboo, you know, where we have this mythology of progress that says that we're the first, you know, we are the first people in human history who who noticed what, you know, 1 + 1 is. Everyone else before us was stupid, and which is frankly stupid.
Yeah, well, and that takes you back to Pythagoras, who was also an occultist, you know, and
the man was a sorcerer.
Yeah,
he was also a philosopher. He invented the word philosopher. He was a mathematician. He was, you know, he was a really smart guy, but he was a wizard. They didn't wear pointy hats with moons and stars on them in those days, but if they had, he would have worn one.
Yeah, and so, you know, and it's, these are just, we're just hitting on a few of these. And, So why though? Like, why is that part of our history swept? Why do you think anyway? Is it swept aside and covered up so much?
Well, the problem is that the idea of progress is so emotionally important to so many people. We have, it's frankly a rumor at this point. People believe in progress the way that your Bible-believing Baptist believes in salvation by the Word of God. Progress is going to save us. Progress is going to take us to the stars. And progress means this particular kind of giddy pseudo-rationalism, materialist atheist ideology. But if you believe that, then you have to believe that everything that anybody thought before the scientific revolution was completely wrong. You have to ignore everything that everyone achieved before then, because otherwise you start looking at history and you start looking at the rise and fall of societies and you realize that, you know, our society, you know, we've achieved a lot of things, but so did other societies. They just achieved them in different fields. And then all of a sudden you start realizing that maybe we're not so special after all. That maybe, you know, yeah, we've built our kind of society and we've achieved some marvelous things with it, but we're not, well, among other things, we're not going to the stars, but that's another question. That's another point entirely. You know, all of this mythology that treats us as the, you know, the favored children of destiny and the one group of people in all of history that ever, you know, understood the world the way it really is and all that kind of stuff. That doesn't stand up well. And the whole reason why we have this whole rationalist skeptic movement, all of these people running around denouncing anything that has anything to do with magic or the occult or monsters or the unexplained or the paranormal, they're defensive. They're desperately trying to cling to this fantasy of specialness, this fantasy of gizmocentric entitlement. Where, you know, if you relax and recognize that we're, you know, we've built a civilization, other people have had other civilizations, we've done some neat things, other people did some neat things, then you can say, okay, so, you know, we're not destiny's darlings. We are following our own path through history, and we're doing some stuff, and maybe we can learn some things that some of these other people did back in the day. Maybe we can learn something from the alchemists and from Pythagoras and from the Buddha and from all these other wise people who maybe had some things to teach that we could stand learning, just as some of the things that we've invented, like running water and sanitation, are things that a lot of other people have been going, wow, that's cool.
And if nothing else, at least for me, it's a whole lot more interesting when you dig into some of this.
There's that. Yeah, the great problem with the rationalists, the great problem with this sort of rationalist, skeptic, atheist business, is that the universe they imagine is dull. It's just, you know, lumps of dead matter bumping into each other, which is, watching things bump into each other is fine if you're playing pool or watching or playing bumper or riding a bumper car, but it gets old after a while.
That's true. And I think, and you bring up some of the more popular religions taking part in this a little bit. And so I'll try to shuffle in here a few of what I believe are some of your frequently asked questions, even though it might not be entirely genuine, because I have a feeling I kind of already know what the answer might be, but I bet some people listening will wonder some of these.
Uh-huh. So absolutely.
Is there such thing as a Christian mysticism or Christian magic?
Oh, good heavens, yes. Christian mysticism has been a major, many Christian churches actually admit to Christian mysticism. The Eastern Orthodox churches, the Episcopalian church, they have a lot of mystics. The Catholics have a lot of mystics. It's only in a few of the really narrow Protestant sects that they really get into no mysticism at all. As for Christian occultism, there's a lot of it. There has been a lot of it since, there's a guy named Morton Smith who wrote this fascinating book called Jesus the Magician. And he argues on the basis of a lot of really good evidence that not only that, you know, whatever else Jesus of Nazareth was or did, he practiced and taught magic to the apostles. And that the oldest strata of Christianity is actually magical religion. People nowadays wet themselves if you suggest that, but in fact that's very common. Most of the religions around the world combine faith in God or gods or what have you with spiritual practices that you can use to better your own life. And the claim is that back in the day, Christianity included a lot of that. Unfortunately, Christianity got hijacked by the Roman Empire. You had all of this effort to turn it into this rigid hierarchy to tell people what to do, and it never really recovered. And so a lot of the Christian magicians had to go underground. And, of course, you had the risk of getting burned at the stake and things like that. But, for example, there is a Catholic saint of magic. That's Saint Cyprian of Antioch. Christian magicians have been, you know, doing the usual saint thing, all the ones in like the Catholic Church and so on. Cyprian of Antioch is the patron saint of Christian wizards. It's actually kind of a funny story. The tale goes that Cyprian of Antioch was a pagan sorcerer, and some guy hired him because here was this Christian virgin, and this guy wanted to get into her panties, of course, the typical thing. And so the guy paid Cyprian a lot of money. He said, sure, you know, I'll conjure up some spirits, send a spirit of lust over to her and this kind of stuff, see what we can do. But he called up these spirits, and basically sick them, and they came back saying, we can't mess with her. And he's going, what do you mean you can't mess with her? Well, she has protection. She's protected by this Christ, and we can't mess with him. He's got better magic than we do. And Cyprian, being a smart occultist, said, so you're saying that this Christ guy is more powerful than you are? And the spirits are going, yeah. And so he says, get lost then. And he went and became a Christian and became the founder of a school of Christian occultism. Because he went for where the power was. And so you have, from that time straight through to this, you have people who are devout Christians, who command spirits and raise power in the name of Jesus, and who are typically the ones I have met, certainly, they're good, moral, upstanding people who practice magic in the name of Christ. Yeah, I know that there are a lot of people behind pulpits who insist you can't do that, but people have been doing it all along. And it seems to work pretty well. And, you know, I'm not going to cast judgment as to you know, who is having what kind of afterlife, but if the guy was right to say by their fruits you shall know them, the Christian occultists I've known were generally a pretty cool bunch of people who did a lot of good to a lot of people, and I'm not sure that can be said to all the about all the people who've denounced them. So go on.
Yeah, and as for yourself, Kate, unless I'm wrong, you're pretty open about being not only into the druidical orders, but a grand archdruid. Yeah.
Well, I'm not a grand archdruid at this point. I served 12 years as grand archdruid of the Ancient Order of Druids in America from 2003 to 2015. After 12 years, I was about wrung out. And so, fortunately, the order was doing well. There was somebody else raring to step into the place. So I stepped out. Gordon Cooper became the grand archdruid, and he's busy being wrung out by that right now. So I'm technically an archdruid emeritus. but yeah, no, I'm a druid. I worship the divine through nature, and that's the way druids have for a very long time. That's my religion. And you're right, I'm very open about it.
And so I've run across some people who feel like there's no real place that for them. Like some people have said, you know, a lot of listeners on my show reach out to me in different ways, and one mm-hmm. unexpected way is every now and then I'll hear a little bit of say a young lady saying, it's really interesting, and I can't really find a place anywhere else because I feel like nature is my church, and I feel mm-hmm. more like other living beings out there than just the ones mm-hmm. I see. And mm-hmm. maybe I'm just a hippie, and I'm thinking, you might not be a hippie. You might be closer to druid, and so I'm
you
curious.
You might be a druid. Yeah.
Yeah, so what does this mean as a druid?
Well, one of the things that we found consistently, nobody converts to druidry. What happens is you find out about druidry, you find out that, you know, druids worship the divine as through nature. You know, that nature is our church, and nature is our holy book. And people will find out about that and go, wow, well, that's what I've always thought. And so, you know, we say, okay, well, then you may be a druid. Here, you know, have these, here's some stuff to read. And, of course, you know, go hang out and talk to your local tree. And, but that's almost always what happens. People come and say, wow, yeah, this is what I've always felt. This is what I've always believed. And so, you know, we don't proselytize. And we also don't insist that ours is the only way. If the divine is infinite and we are finite, okay, and I think we can all grant that, then, A, there's no way that we can understand the divine, okay? We can't. Come on, our brains are 6 inches long. There's not that much room for really complicated thoughts in that. Our brains are 6 inches long. The universe is hundreds of trillions of light years across. One of these things is not large enough to understand the other. And so, when people start saying, well, this is the one true way, well, you know, maybe it's the right way for you. And if it is the right way for you, that's great. But, you know, it would be nice if you wouldn't be a jerk about it. And that's kind of the basic druid teaching is, don't be a jerk about your religion. Practice your faith. Treat other people well. If somebody wants to hear about druidry, well, tell me about this druid stuff. That's great. But don't go ramming it down their throats. That's not going to do anyone any good. So that's kind of our approach. You know, and other people disagree, and that's fine, too. The world is a complicated place.
Yeah, and so another question, I don't know how frequent it is, but I have a mm-hmm. feeling people will wonder is, well, is all of this stuff the same as the New Age stuff I've seen with UFOs and crystals? Although I have plenty of answers to that, and it's part of the reason why I was so obsessed when I found your book, New Encyclopedia of the Cult, is like, now here's some real stuff in the wrong section. Like this is getting deep and like the thin New Age stuff. I'm giving away my prejudice about this answer. But anyway, are you New Age? Is all of this just New Age
stuff? No. If anything, I'm old age. The New Age movement, what typically happens in any time when magic is sufficiently public, what usually happens is that you get people who take kind of the money slope lessons, the very basic stuff, and they pick that up and they run with it and they build up some kind of pop philosophy around it. And it often has some good things to teach, but it also often has some problems. But the New Age is simply the latest version of that. They've got most of the basic ideas of the New Age were ultimately borrowed from basic occult instructions from some of the old correspondence courses in the middle of the 20th century. Things like the law of attraction, which we heard so much about at one point. That's like from lesson number 2 of a correspondence course I have. It's stuck in my file cabinet. Somebody picked up and ran with it. And so it's very basic. And it's not entirely accurate. You know, when people go, well, I create my own reality. No, you don't. You help create. You co-create parts of your own reality. Well, no question. You have a powerful influence on the universe that you experience, but you don't make the whole thing. And, you know, they get kind of flustered when you tell them that. But the thing is, these things like that, these kind of pop culture occult teachings, watered-down occult teachings, they also serve a place. Because a lot of people experience those, they read about them, they say, well, this is interesting, but I have the sense there's something deeper. Then they go looking for something deeper, and very often they find it. So, you know, it all serves a purpose.
Yeah, these are excellent answers.
Thank you.
I've been... I've been throwing a few that I call false questions because they weren't mm-hmm. necessarily burning in my mind, but I know for sure they were burning in listeners who haven't really experienced you yet.
Yeah, and that's totally cool because we're here to talk to the listeners, and they, you know, if they're not like jumping up and down on the phone or something like that, or sending you frantic emails saying ask him this, you have to do your best.
Yeah, and so to get back to one that I wanted to pick your brain a little bit on, although so much so that I don't even know what my question is, but I found myself in the recent, I don't know, couple of years or so getting getting really obsessed with reading a lot of Carl Jung, and I've really mm-hmm. loved a lot of what he has to say.
Good.
And you know, and I go back to seeing reading a little bit about where you say he fits in, and I end mm-hmm. up going back to Jung quite a bit when I get into mm-hmm. stuff on literature too, and how mm-hmm. and how mm-hmm. these monsters kind of end up, you know, living simultaneously inside us and seeing, you know, and we mm-hmm. see these things outside that are different mm-hmm. versions of these brains we've inherited over millions of years. But I'm kind of curious, I want to pick your brain a little bit about kind of Jung's approach to the mm-hmm. numinous and the transcendent and these kinds of things.
Okay. The first thing to keep in mind, and this is a little unpopular among Jungian psychologists, but I think a very strong case can be made for it. Carl Jung was the most influential occultist of the 20th century. And the way he was influential is that he pretended to be a psychologist. The guy was a wizard. He practiced astrology. He practiced magical methods of meditation. He had this whole system that was basically magic and psychological drag. And because he put it in the scientific drag, he was able to get a lot of people who normally would have gone, oh, occult, I have to run for, you know, hide under the bed, to take it seriously. So it was a marvelous move on his part. It was a very, very clever move on his part. The gimmick that he used, and it's a very sensible gimmick, is to pay attention to the fact that we experience most of what other occultists would call the inner planes or the astral plane, the spiritual world. We experience this through our minds. We don't experience these things through our senses except under certain very specific conditions. And so he was paying attention to, okay, what does the mind experience? And the mind experiences, there's the stuff we experience consciously. There's the conscious mind. We have our thoughts. We have our feelings. We have our sensations, the things that come in through our sense organs and so on. Okay. And then let's go down a level. And then we have the personal unconscious, which is the stuff we don't think about, the stuff we've chosen not to think about in many cases, stuff from childhood or stuff that we were upset enough that we have like walled it off and we just won't let ourselves think about it, and various other things like that. And then you go deeper and you start getting into a realm that he called the collective unconscious, which is a realm where we share, where it's not personal anymore. Your collective unconscious, my collective unconscious, it's the same stuff. And so images and presences and powers that have been there since human beings became human, they're still there. And they can be contacted and interacted with. And he had a very specific approach to interacting with them to get from the kind of ordinary, half-awake, normal state of the unawakened human mind that most people stumble through their lives in, to what he called individuation, the point where you had actually become an individual. And this is shocking. Most people say, well, I'm an individual. Do you recall the Monty Python movie, The Life of Brian?
Yeah, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Brian there is shouting out the window, you are all individuals, and they all shout back in perfect unison, yes, we are all individuals.
And then the one guy jumps up and says, but yeah. I'm not.
But I'm not.
I'm not. Yeah, exactly. You are all different. And he goes, I'm not.
Yeah,
and
he's yes, the you're one all, different guy. Yes, we are all different. And the thing is that the reason we all laugh at that is that we know it's true, that we claim to be individuals, we claim to be unique and to be thinking our own thoughts, and most of the time we're just going through the motions. Most of the time, what's in our brains we got out of the media out of our parents' prejudices or out of what our friends say. And our idea of who we are is equally shaped by outside phenomena. It's a long, slow process to actually dig down deep and get in touch with the roots of who you truly are. And that's what Jung was trying to teach. And in fact, that's something that occultists have been teaching all along. It's a very important part of the process. But his genius was that he figured out a way to talk about it in psychological language. And so one of the other things, the place where he got risky, of course, is that he talked about how these things, quote, in your mind, unquote, can affect the outer world, can be experienced in the outer world. His book on synchronicity is, well, of course, it was co-written with him and a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, named Wolfgang Pauli. And then you also had his book on UFOs, which is frankly the smartest thing on that that's ever been written, and where he's really talking about the fact that what we see around us is like an ink blot in a psychological text, and we extract images from it.
Yeah, and that's a fantastic rundown of Jung, by the way, with some really specific references.
I have spent years, many, many years reading Jung. I have half a bookshelf full of his stuff. His work is very important, and I think it deserves much more attention among occultists and people in general. There's an enormous amount of meat there.
And it's worth everyone knowing that I didn't hit John Michael Greer with any questions beforehand. He wanted to shoot from the hip, and I was happy with that. And so this is all coming off the top of his head. If you're wondering, wow, that's a really good summary of Jung and where exactly he's split off from Freud. And well, yeah, that's right.
Well, so, no, the thing is, fortunately, you've been asking me questions about things that I'm kind of obsessive about. There's a lot of things you could ask me about where I would end up going, but most of them don't have much place on a monster show, so I think we're in good shape.
And so we've been talking, bringing up magic a lot, and so I want to hit you with a two-part question that might go a little bit back more to your frequently asked questions. Mm-hmm. If I had to pin you down to say what is magic, then one, what is magic, and then two, isn't it dangerous to dabble in?
Okay, those are two excellent questions, and yes, in fact, those are questions I field all the time. What is magic? The best definition I know is the one that was come up with by Dion Fortune, who was an English magician during the first half of the 20th century. And her definition ran like this. Magic is the art and science of causing change in consciousness in accordance with will. Now, when I say that, most people misunderstand that. They think, oh, you mean change in my consciousness. I didn't say that. Change in consciousness. It can be a change in someone else's consciousness. It can be a change in consciousness that doesn't necessarily exist inside a brain, because one of the basic theses of magic is that our minds are not just meat. There are levels of ourselves that are not just physical. There is a thing called the soul. That term has been misused in many different ways, but it exists, and so on and so forth. So causing change in consciousness, everything that's done with magic is done with or through consciousness. That's the key. Now, is it dangerous to dabble in magic? Absolutely. It's dangerous to dabble in anything. I'm sure most Christians would agree it's a really bad idea to dabble in Christianity. If you're going to do it whole hog. In exactly the same way, if you're going to take up magic, you need to take it up seriously. You need to be aware of the potential risks. You need to follow a good, clear course of instruction, and if possible, you need to have some idea of how other people have done with that course of instruction. Unfortunately, there's a lot of options these days. But no, dabbling is a bad idea. Dabbling in anything, I would not recommend it. You know, dabbling in auto repair. You want to learn if you're going to get under the hood, you need to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And exactly the same thing is true of magic. If you're going to be working with the basic structures of consciousness itself in your mind and the minds of others, you need to be careful. You need to know what you're doing. And so that's why a proper magical school will teach you some very basic techniques and then walk you through a lot of theory and a lot of philosophy and a lot of experiential work that will gradually teach you to do that in a safe and constructive fashion. They'll also teach you a lot of ethics, by the way. In a proper school, you get a lot of people these days who are saying, oh, the ethical stuff, that's just old-fashioned nonsense. No. Ethics is as important in magic as sanitation is in surgery, and for the same reason. Things get septic if you neglect them. You have to have a very strong ethical basis, and you have to be very careful that what you're doing is actually to help people and not to hurt people. Because if you do, there's a principle. I gave it a funny name, but it's been known in magical for a long time. I call it the raspberry jam principle. Okay, and the raspberry jam principle works like this: if you put raspberry jam on a slice of bread, you're going to get it on your own fingers, right?
Yeah,
everyone knows that.
Yeah.
In the same way, any magical energy you work with, you're going to get it in yourself. So if you're working with energies of harm, of damage, of despair, of suicide, trying to zap someone, those energies are going to flow through you. They're going to manifest in your own life. They are going to mess you over. If you're working with energies of healing and blessing, that's going to manifest in your life too. Which would you prefer to have in your life? Well, that's magical ethics.
Yeah, and that's, and so I wonder, you know, when I hear like these news stories, like a musician Lana Del Rey working to cast, working with her coven to cast spells on Trump or something. I think at some level I'm like, well, I kind of hope for your sake, Lana Del Rey, that you're not good at it because you might be in some dangerous territory.
No, there are at least two things to watch out for here. First of all, yeah, you know, back away from the car crash before it happens. Because if you're flinging curses around, your life is going to end up as a smoking crater. I have seen this over and over again. People who insist that, well, that's not true. Or they insist that, oh, you know, but I'm doing it in a good cause. I want to hurt this bad person. It does not matter. Okay? The ends do not justify the means. And in magic, you know, using nasty means, it doesn't matter what the ends are, what your goal is, how high your ambitions are, it doesn't matter. If you are engaging in curses, your life is going to turn into a smoking crater. I've seen it over and over again. And yeah, even if she's incompetent at it, she's going to mess herself over. But there's another factor that I don't think these people have dealt with. They're doing all this stuff out in public, okay? And I don't know if it has occurred to them that there are a lot of people on the other side who also practice magic. Yeah. And if they're busy putting out all the details of these curses that they're engaged in, it's like if you're in a war, okay, and you're trying to invade the other guy's territory, and you publish the plans of where your soldiers are going to march and where they're going to jump on, you're going to be defeated. You're going to be crushed because they're going to know where to have their forces waiting. Magic is the same way. There is one of the basic principles of magic goes back a very long ways. There are these four basic magical virtues that you practice, and you do these, and you do good magic, and you don't do these, and your magic falls flat. To know, to will, to dare, and to be silent. Or, as one of my teachers used to say back in the days, to know, to will, to dare, and to shut the up. Okay? You've got to know what you're doing. You've got to have a strong will that you can direct, so you can direct all your energies into it. You need to dare the consequences and accept what's going to happen as a result, and you need to be silent about it so that other people don't know what you're up to. Because if they know, they can counter it and they can mess you over. All these people who are doing these anti-Trump workings and are loudly parading about, they're doing this, we're going, you know, in such and such date, we're all going to gather and, you know, send some, you know, vent our anger at the Orange Man. The poor fools. They're just setting themselves up for misery and defeat.
Because I wondered something similar. I wonder, like, well, what makes you think he wouldn't just, you know, drop some cash and hire his own crew to fight back?
Yeah, he doesn't even have to. There are a lot of people occultists are on all sides of the political spectrum. You have all the way from the far left to the far right and everything in between. And if you go online and do some poking around, you can find websites by people who are doing magic to protect Donald Trump because they think they are in favor of his policies. They think that, you know, he is the president. They're saving the United States by keeping these bad people from destroying him. Whether you agree with them or not, that's their view. And they're going to be putting just as much force into their magic as, you know, these people are putting into theirs. So do you really want to make everything that public? Well, you know.
Yeah. And since it is a monster themed show, just to stay in the dark side a little bit, are, you know, the average listener of the show or the average American out there, you know, the you know, aside from, say, anybody targeting them directly, are there real dangers out there? Are there real dangers, say, demonic or malevolent forces? Are there real monsters out there that people are in danger of? And then if they're afraid that they are, you know, where would you suggest they turn?
Okay. The first thing to keep in mind is that, yes, there are creepy things out there. And there are things out there that can harm human beings. When religions all around the world talking about demons, and a demon is simply a malevolent spirit, a spirit that for whatever reason hurts people, there are a lot of them out there. They're not particularly powerful in our world, but they do function. And especially if you engage in the dumber sort of dabbling, you can end up tangling with them. What do you do about it? Well, there's a lot of ways. The basic practices of religion are, among other things, a good way to keep any religion are a good way to keep things like that at bay. Especially those religions that have some of the sacraments, some of the ritual stuff, and so on. Those are very powerful in that way. If you don't happen to belong to such a religion, there are other modes. Some of the stuff that I teach in the book Monsters toward the end, there are various rituals and various amulets and things that you can use. But, you know, mostly it's a matter of common sense. It's a matter of recognizing that dabbling is a bad idea, that you don't want to dabble in brain surgery, and know what you, and don't put yourself into a situation where you're dealing with stuff you don't know about, and you have no idea how to control it.
Yeah, and so, and I'm just now realizing that I've been pushing you way past the time that I've promised to keep you.
Nonetheless, I think we're just about coming up on the hour. So yeah.
Yeah. So I was. And this has been fantastic, and I'm really grateful once again that you've taken the time to talk with me about this stuff. Yeah. And I think it's going to be a really cool experience for listeners to
good.
To hear
I have had a good time. I have had a good time. And let me ask you one question before you close. You mentioned H.P. Lovecraft. You're a fan.
Yeah, huge fan. And I wanted to, like, if I could find out a little bit more about your fiction, which I believe has a Lovecraftian bent, and kind of curious about how far away you are from, say, some of Lovecraft's old haunts in Providence.
Oh, I can walk from here to the place where Lovecraft was born. I can walk to the various places where he lived his life. I'm on the other side of the Seekonk River, but it's you know, for me it's a couple of miles.
That wow.
Is all.
Okay.
Lovecraft's grave is not that far away from here. People leave strange things at that grave. but yeah, my recent fiction. I've done various kinds of science fiction and fantasy over the years, but my recent fiction is most of it is a 7-volume series called The Weird of Hali, and it stands H.P. Lovecraft. It basically takes H.P. Lovecraft's universe, which I love, you know, the tentacled horrors and everything, and it stands it on its head. The tentacled horrors were actually the good guys.
I like that.
Yeah, it's well, the thing is, come on, everyone actually loves the monsters. I mean, only the most extreme Lovecraft geeks remember any of his protagonists except Randolph Carter, okay? I mean, do you even remember the name of the protagonist of The Call of Cthulhu?
No, but I could tell
no,
you
Cthulhu nobody does,
and yokes
but
off
everybody remembers Cthulhu, they remember Nyarlathotep, they remember all of the, you know, they, everyone, you know, they know about Shoggoths and Elder Things and the whole nine yards. So that's where all the fun is, right? So I figured, let's have their side of the story. So I ended up, five of the 7 volumes are out. The 6th will be out in August and the 7th in October. And I also have a spinoff volume that will be out in just about a week now. One more on the 17th, on Wednesday the 17th, called The Shoggoth Concerto, which is a odd and quiet, rather funny, rather unusual story about classical music and Shoggoths. I like Shoggoths. Shoggoths are fun. And so, I kind of went to town on this Shoggoth thing. But it's turned into this marvelous sort of an epic fantasy with tentacles. And each of the 7 volumes in the main series is kind of sort of loosely based on some of Lovecraft's stories, and of course there's some Clark Ashton Smith thrown in there, and some of the writers that either worked with him or the writers that he was influenced by. I borrowed a lot of stuff from them, but it's basically this is the other side of the story. This is the tentacled horrors and the cult and all those cultists that everyone thinks are the bad guys. Well, maybe not so much. So they're fun stories, and I have been having a whale of a good time writing them and seeing them published and having people enjoy them.
Well, that's really cool, because I ended up using you as a big fueling mechanism for a lot of my own fiction, and so I'm really glad to find out that you're doing the same thing. You're using your own work to fuel.
No, I actually started when I originally started writing. This was many, many years ago when I was in junior high school. I originally wrote fantasy fiction. And I submitted several novels to get published. They were horribly bad. Of course, I got rejection slips. And so I ended up going into writing nonfiction because it's much easier to get published there. But I have, recently, again, I've been able to gradually work my way back to doing more fiction. And it's a lot of fun.
It really is. And for those interested in your fiction, or say in your nonfiction books that we've been referencing, or even in some of the books you've edited, and we've only just touched on a couple of subjects that you cover. We haven't even talked about your focus on peak oil and industrialization. But for those who want to find out more, where can we guide them? Where should they go looking for books and finding out more about you?
I hate to send people to the big internet company, but unfortunately, probably the single best place to look up all my books is my Amazon page. If you go to Amazon and enter John Michael Greer in the search box, it'll take you to my Amazon page, and that will give you a fair idea of where the books are.
I'll have the link in this description as well, by the way.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, and other than that, because I publish a whole bunch of different publishers, my Dreamwits journal, which is ecosophia.dreamwits.org. I always publish those my new releases there, and there I also do a lot of chatting and things like that goes on at that, and I also have a blog at www.ecosophia.org, ecosophia.org, that has a post every Wednesday on some weird topic or other.
Well, that's fantastic, and once again, it's been a huge honor and a huge privilege to get to talk with you. And I'm really thankful that you've been so generous with your time and your insights and even your willingness to come on a little show like The Monster Professor.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on. I have enjoyed it.